Hawaii, working on experimental protocols called human dog communication. And then he used to help look at the about information geometry, primitive information geometry, and quantum theory.
Thanks, Owen. Quantum theory is an extraordinarily successful physical theory, and as such, it gives us every reason to think that it captures, in its formalism, fundamental aspects of the way in which nature works. It would be of inestimable value to clearly articulate what these features are, to articulate them in a form that we can intuitively grasp. However, the articulation of these features has been hindered by the fact that the quantum formalism in which these features are somehow encoded consists of objects such as complex states and operators that our intuitions cannot directly relate to. As a consequence, most of the progress that's been made in quantum foundations has tended to take the quantum formalism as a given and attempted to try to form concepts which enable us to understand in various ways how quantum reality differs from classical reality. And it's employed, immediately after the formalism was created, concepts like complementarity and entanglement were formulated to express certain of its features. And then in the following years, concepts like contextuality, non-locality, no cloning, which required much more effort. There, one is comparing the predictions of quantum theory with a classical model which has certain properties, and one shows that quantum theory is in violation of the predictions of those models. So that's much more subtle work. And then looking at the quantum formalism as a mathematical structure, of course, one can actually individuate certain features that it has, and one finds those surprising. For example, the fact that quantum theory sort of the states live at a different level to the observed quantities, the probabilities, and that there is a definite relation that connects them together. And obviously, things like the complex form of the quantum formalism. And then there are things like high-level features, like the symmetric transition probabilities, which perhaps we might have some more intuition about, which are sort of high-level properties. A picture like this immediately raises the question, are we missing something? Are there concepts which aren't present here and haven't yet been conceived, which are actually crucial for understanding the nature of the quantum world? And the picture also raises the question whether there are certain of these concepts which are really crucial to understanding the nature of quantum reality, and others which are in some sense secondary or derived. For example, one might think that perhaps non-locality and no signaling are really, really important, and one can't do without that. And some people have suggested that. Or one might think that contextuality is really important. So how do we know? How do we formulate answers to either of these two questions? Well, one way to do that, potentially, is to say, well, OK, if I really believe that these concepts, this is just a pure example. I'm not saying that this is actually possible, but let's suppose someone thought that these concepts were really sufficient to characterize quantum theory. Then it ought to be possible to mathematize them in a natural way, in a mathematical framework that makes intuitive sense to us, and to derive quantum theory, derive the quantum formalism from that. And if we could do that, it would give us a great deal of confidence that we've got our hands on the essence of quantum theory. That doesn't preclude the possibility of another set of concepts also leading to a derivation of quantum theory, but it means at least this perspective is an adequate one. In this sense. So this is the program of reconstruction, and it's something that's generated quite a lot of interest in recent times. And the essence of the idea, in simple terms, is to express how we think nature works, or rather how we think that part of nature described by quantum theory works, mathematize it in some natural way, and to derive the quantum formalism from that. And the hope is that in that process, we'll gain a much deeper understanding of where the various features of quantum theory actually come from. And along the way, if we have to make formal assumptions in the process of mathematization that we don't have a good physical justification for, then that points up a deficiency in our understanding and hopefully presents a possible point of growth for a better understanding in the future. So what I'm going to do today is just outline one particular reconstruction of quantum theory. It uses four of the ideas I just had up and introduces the concept of information in a very fundamental way via this thing called the information metric, which I'll explain in a moment. And it introduces an information theoretic principle, which basically says that transformations over state space must preserve the metric over state space. And that metric is actually inherited from the information metric, as I'll show you in a moment. So let me just go over the preliminaries. I'm considering measurements at the outset to be probabilistic. I'm just taking that as a given. And I'm just going to consider measurements with finite number of possible outcomes. And I am also going to consider only reproducible measurements. So when we immediately repeat the measurement, we get the same result with certainty. And now the information metric. The information metric is also known as the Fisher-Rao metric. It is basically a metric over the space of probability distributions. And what it does is gives us a measure of distance over that, over the probability simplex. And it can be thought of as measuring how difficult it is to distinguish two nearby probability distributions, given only a finite number of samples from each one. And it's a very fundamental object that arises in probability theory as soon as we start to think about probabilities, not just as real numbers, but as things which are connected to frequencies. So in other words, the information metric arises because of a tension between probabilities on the one hand, theoretical descriptions, and frequencies, which are the things that the data that we actually get. The data never completely determines the probabilities, hence the tension between the two things. To see how this comes about quantitatively a little bit, consider a game where Alice has two coins, A and B, characterized by probability distributions P and P dash, and she chooses one of them, tosses it n times, and sends the data to Bob, and challenges Bob to say which coin was tossed. And then you can ask the question, well, let's suppose that Bob knows about these two coins, but he just doesn't know which one was tossed. So that's the only thing he doesn't know. How much information does he gain about which coin was tossed as a result of receiving this data from Alice? And simple application of probability theory tells us that the information gained is some function of the number of tosses and this quantity here, ds squared, in the special case where these coins are very close by on a probability simplex. And this ds squared is the information metric. And the quarter here is just to make things neater. But so this is the information metric. And this function f is determined by our choice of entropy function. So since we've chosen our entropy function, our uncertainty function, then that's it. That determines f. So the thing to take home from this is that the ds squared, this metric, arises naturally and immediately as soon as we start to think about probabilities from the point of view of actually like tossing coins and trying on the basis of the data to infer what probabilities are. So one thing that's very useful in a moment, is to make a change of variables. So this is the probability simplex in three dimensions. If we make this change of variables to the square roots of probability, then the information metric coincides with the Euclidean metric. So I've introduced little qi as a square roots of pi here. So the relevance of that will become apparent in just a moment. Okay, so going back to this picture, these three here basically are background assumptions. They together justify using the classical probability theory plus the information metric as our foundation. And they collectively form what I call the information geometric framework. So the derivation now proceeds as follows in three steps. In step one, step two, and step three, we take these concepts and we formalize them, and then we see where we get in each case. Complementarity. So going back to the measurement, measurement A, you've got n possible outcomes. So now how do we formalize complementarity in this framework? Well, complementarity, by that I mean, at the very simplest level, the idea that when we perform a measurement on a physical system, we can't access simultaneously all of the degrees of freedom that determine the state of the system. So in contrast to classical physics, somehow there's a constraint on us, on what we can get out. So one of the very simplest ways one can express complementarity in this framework, where all we have to work with are events and probabilities of events, is to introduce an intermediate layer between the measurement and the outcomes. So what I do is to simply postulate that when we perform a measurement, there are one of two n possible events that are realized that for some reason aren't observable, with probabilities P1 through P2n, which are determined by the state of the system. And the idea is that the outcomes we observe coarse grain over the events. So when event one or two occurs, we see outcome one. And similarly, three and four, we see outcome two. So this is a formally very simple idea, and the idea is to see how far it can take us. Now, what this means is that the state of the system is determined by these two n probabilities thus far, and we can collect them together in this unit vector Q, and I'm going to impose the information metric at this point over this case. Obviously, this is just symbolic. Obviously, this is a two n dimensional thing in reality. And at the minute, this metric isn't doing any work for us. It's just unused part of the mathematical furniture, and it'll be given some physical meaning in just a moment. So the step two is to ask how we represent physical transformations on the state of the system. So here we have, say, we have the state space, and we're imagining a map back to the state space. And this is the point where the information metric is given some physical meaning. We require that the distance between these two states with respect to the information metric is preserved under the mapping. And these two are assumed to be infinitesimally close. So we're considering that special case always. Now, what's the physical idea behind this? Essentially, the idea is as follows. Because of the assumption of complementarity, it means that any given measurement can only see effectively half of the degrees of freedom at any given moment. So one opens straight away the possibility that there are more than one measurement, and these different measurements see different perspectives. They see different things about the system, and what they see isn't actually equivalent. And so the idea emerges of, well, invariant quantities. Are there any quantities that we can evaluate with respect to any of these perspectives and that we'll get the same result? So the idea, the analogy that you might have in mind is in special relativity, the space-time distance between two points is actually independent of which inertial frame you're in. So that's the background thought, that different measurements provide different measurement perspectives on the same system, and we're thinking that this here is an invariant quantity, the distance between the states. That's all very well, but we have a problem. If we really impose this constraint, we're really restricted in what kind of transformations we can do. We can't do any continuous one-to-one transformations from here to here. It's just not possible. All we can do is permute the axes, which is very uninteresting. So we can't do anything like capture temporal evolution. So if this is where we stop, we are essentially going nowhere. So how do we get around this? Well, one very simple thing to do is to simply say that we're going to, from a formal point of view, extend the state space to the whole of the unit hypersphere. If we do that, this condition implies that the mapping must be orthogonal, which is not a trivial thing. That's some content. There's some content there. Why would we do this? Well, from a formal point of view, it's a very natural thing to do. I don't have, at the present moment, a good physical reason for it. So this is the point in the derivation where I'm introducing a formal assumption for which I don't have a good physical explanation. The final step is to introduce the idea of global gauge invariance. By that, I mean that if I have a physical system, I can find a representation of it, of that state, such that if the state is given by a set of real numbers, I can find some subset of that set of real numbers, and I can displace them all by the same amount, and it gives rise to no changes and any predictions that I would make on the basis of the state. So this is the essential idea that I want to formalize. So how do I do that? Well, let's look at the state Q and imagine measurement A being performed on it. Well, measurement A tells us about these little pi, P1 through Pn. So we can actually write Q in terms of the pi and some other variables, the theta I. And there's no loss of generality in writing Q in this way. So we certainly can't play around with the little pi. I mean, that would immediately be detectable experimentally. So what we do have is some freedom about what we do to the thetas. So the assumption here that I make is to say that theta I is some function theta of chi I, so we can rewrite Q in this form now, and assume that this is a global gauge transformation of the state of the system. In other words, we displace all of the chi's, the n chi's, by the same amount, and it doesn't change our predictions. So now we apply this in two ways. First of all, we require that the measure induced by the metric over state space is consistent with this global gauge transformation. What does that mean? Well, we have a metric over the state space, which we can write like this. And when we make this change of variables to pi and chi i, then the metric becomes this. And if we take the square root of the determinant of that metric, we get this measure, and it has this form. The actual mathematical details aren't important. I just want to take away the idea that from this metric, we can get a measure over the state space. So the measure invariance assumption that I'm making is that this measure is actually independent. It's invariant under displacement of the chi variables. So basically, you've got these theta variables, theta 1, theta 2, and so on. The assumption is that theta 1, for example, equals some function of chi 1. Theta 2 is some function of chi 2, and those functions are all the same. So. Well, okay, so what happens now is that because of this condition, that function is determined. You find that it has to be linear in chi because of this condition here. So what it means is that Q can now be written in this form here, explicitly. And if we just define phi 1 equals A chi 1 plus B and so on, then we can rewrite Q in a more familiar form, where I'm just making that identification. All right. The second thing that we're going to pull out of this idea of global gauge invariance is just a specific postulate which says just that. That if I have a state Q, and I do now an orthogonal transformation on it to get state Q dash, that if I make a displacement of these phis here, then it leaves the PI dash invariant. What does that mean? It means that I'm making measurement A on that state. What I measure are these probabilities. These probabilities shouldn't be affected by a displacement of these phis. So that's the assumption. And what this is a very strong constraint on what M can be. M, we said so far, is an orthogonal transformation. But it turns out that M is very restricted, and it looks kind of unpleasant, but I think you should see it. So this is the case where M is a four-dimensional matrix, and it takes the form of an array of 2 by 2 submatrices, and each matrix is just a scale rotation matrix. There are two types, type 1 and type 2. Type 2, it's a scale rotation reflection matrix. This probably doesn't look familiar, but at this moment, we actually have the quantum formalism. It's just written in real terms, so it's not familiar, probably. What's the correspondence? So we have those states and those transformations. Let's simply write the state in this complex form here. And that there's a one-to-one correspondence, obviously, between them. And then ask the question, well, what do these transformations correspond to? Well, type 1 are just unitary transformations, and type 2 are just anti-unitary transformations. And there's a one-to-one correspondence here. So every unitary is a type 1, every type 1 is a unitary. So we can as it were, forget that this, and we can just work with the complex form of the formalism at this point. So that's more or less all I have time to explain. In further steps, one can derive the Born rule, tensor product rule, and the other main things that we need to apply quantum theory. What have we learned? Well, I think the most striking thing is that in step 3 of the derivation, okay, prior to step 3, we only have a real formalism. We have no complex numbers, no complex structure. In step 3, through the imposition of this very simple idea of global gauge invariance, we're able to get the full complex structure of the quantum formalism. And that, I think, is quite remarkable given that the predictive irrelevance of the overall phase of a pure state in quantum theory is not normally regarded as a big deal, as something of deep physical significance. The derivation, I think, suggests that global gauge invariance is actually far from trivial and actually reflects something quite deep, but I'm not quite sure what that is at this moment. And then the information geometric framework, that actually shows us quite clearly the importance of square roots of probability, and it also shows why the sinusoidal functions of phase enter into quantum theory. And this information theoretic assumption that I've made leads us to transformations of Q being orthogonal, which is already a big step towards unitary and anti-unitary transformations. And so if you take these ideas together with the Born rule and the tensor product rule, which I didn't explain today, but you can derive those relatively easily. If you take those together, then all of these things, these concepts can be derived in the ordinary way. So from the point of view of this picture, these are actually secondary or derived ideas, and these are the fundamental ones. Okay. Thank you for your attention. Sorry? Well, it's a good question. I mean, the thing is, the structure that I'm using from the very beginning is tailored to deal with quantum phenomena. In every respect, essentially, we're using the information geometric framework. So straight away, we're saying, well, measurements are probabilistic. And then we're doing this funny thing of expanding the state space to the entire unit hypersphere. That's something very unobvious from a classical probability point of view. And then, global gauge invariance. It's something that one sees, for example, in the Hamilton-Jacobi equation of classical mechanics. But it's not something that, one thinks about as being a particularly big deal in classical physics, or at least I never did until I realized that it's of so much importance. So this seems to be, And of course, complementarity. I think that's really playing a huge role, because you're saying that, no, there's this huge constraint on what measurements can tell us about systems. You don't just have one measurement that can tell us about everything. Yeah. Authons, did he? I see.
Which are not simply related by the limitation of the order. And still, since what she's reporting is information equivalent to what she would have reported, if she's just a little bit done, the picture has remained unchanged over that. And so, that gives, I think, a useful
That's great. Thank you. Okay, so I think I didn't quite catch that. Could you repeat it? Sorry. Okay. Okay, so the starting point of this whole sort of program is to take measurements as primitive notion and to take their probabilistic nature as a given. So that's the starting point. If one wants to reconstruct quantum theory on the basis of the assertion that no reality or our description of reality should be fundamentally deterministic, and that perhaps the probabilities arise in some way, in some relatively mysterious way, out of that determinism, then of course, you know, one could try to reconstruct quantum theory on that basis, but I don't see how it can be done. And certainly all the reconstructions I'm aware of, and there are about a dozen that I'm aware of, they take the probabilistic nature of measurements as a starting point.
How will you get spectrum of all kinds of gadgets to probably find?
Well, I mean, well, okay, so here I'm deriving the finite dimensional quantum formalism, and I'm saying that you can get the full structure. And then, of course, you have to make these. I mean, I haven't derived the infinite dimensional form. There are difficulties that one encounters in doing that, which I haven't managed to overcome at the moment. So, but the thing is, you've got the full formalism. You can get the commutation relationships. So you've got all the machinery that you need to calculate spectra of molecules and atoms. It's not a problem.